All right. Good morning. Welcome back, day three. How are we doing? Lovely. I thought we'd lose more of you by now. This deep into the week. Welcome. How many of y'all were there last night for Vespers, for Chris Odie's story? I'd never heard that, and I was really moved to hear that Chris had never shared that. So this is what we mean when we talk about, yesterday we closed with a welcoming prayer. Remember we talked about that we've got a similar, this icon right here is a map, not only of society and of the cosmos and of our internal space as well. We've all got a place where we want to create gates of Hades and create an underworld of repression, where the things that we don't like, our pain, our wounds, our shame, the parts that we want to cut off and remove and bury. There's a lot of connections with what Dan Castillo and Paul are talking about in our morning sessions, about how we like to extract and then bury things in the ground. We do that in ourselves. And so it moves me, Chris, to think about even this week where we're approaching the tombs, that something starts coming alive and rattling in you that's been in shadow for long enough that needed to come to light. I'm guessing and hoping that's part of your integration and healing, but for all of us as well. And that this is part of the resurrection that we see, especially Matthew's gospel. It's not just Jesus who's heroically and as a solitary individual coming out of the tombs, but in Matthew's gospel it says all of the dead came out of the tombs and went back to their loved ones. And even the curtain in the temple was torn in two, right? So there's throughout the gospels, and especially in Matthew's and in the icons, there's this larger repercussion. It's not just, well, Jesus died and rose from the grave, and we can sing about that on Easter. There's this larger implication that there's an unleashing, there's a cracking open of all that is separated and removed and buried. And this is the exciting work of the resurrection, event of Christ's resurrection, but that it's universal. It opens up so many systems and think places we thought, well, of course we need the curtain in the temple. Of course we need the dead to be removed from society, and that this gets loosened up throughout the gospel narratives. So at Underground Ministries, we started going into the tombs for years. My book is here, and it tells a lot of the stories of my kind of adventures of falling in love with the men and the women that I met in the jail, where I thought this would be a cool place to study theology. Kind of like Chris Odie's story, I found my people in there. I found a fellowship that was better than any church I'd been part of. So I kept going back because I loved it. I kept going back because maybe Jesus' whole teaching around, did you visit me when I was in prison? Did you clothe me when I was naked? I think a lot of us can hear that as a clever rhetorical device to say, hey, go be a do-gooder, as opposed to maybe Jesus saying, if you want to find the presence of God, I'm telling you where. Monasteries are cool. I've been to a lot, but I've never felt in a monastery what I feel when I go into a jail, solitary confinement unit, into a prison visiting folks. Some kind of cracking open of the mercy of God that I read about in St. Isaac of Syria, that I read about in Evagrius the Solitary, that I'm trying to be still enough to open myself to monasteries. Boom, it cracks open when I'm in these spaces. Maybe Jesus is saying, this is where I like to spend time, close to the tombs, right at that. Progressives, we love to talk about liminal spaces. The opening of the tombs is a liminal space between the living and the dead. So if we are the people that can embrace the liminal space, we should be very comfortable around the tombs, very comfortable around the lockdown doors, because I think this is where the God that liberated the people from Egypt, the God that himself went into the tombs and came out and raised others from the tombs.
Hey, Chris?
Yes, sir?
Can you explain what you mean by liminal spaces?
Yes. Who's heard the phrase liminal space? All right. Who would like to say in two sentences, what is liminal space?
It's that thin space between us and the next door.
Yeah, it's a space the in-between, not this and not this. Right in between, kind of like the threshold, the in-betweenness. And so I'd like to think this, the breaking open of the gates of Hades, within.
It's liminal.
Liminal.
Not limitable.
Yeah, not limitable. Okay. Liminal, right. Great, and so
one of the best examples I've always heard used is just the simple example of a doorway, the passage, that you were simultaneously both in and not in both spaces. There's this moment where you exist in both rooms and yet you don't exist in either.
Liminal space, the opening of the tombs, the opening of the gates of Hades. And this is terrifying. And what we're going to be doing this morning is we're going to talk about how our program, One Parish, One Prisoner, came to be. It's both going to be scriptural as well as very practical, because we're interested in helping communities everywhere get involved in the practice of resurrection. And anyone a fan of Wendell Berry's famous poem, The Mad Farmer Liberation Front?
Yeah.
The very last line haunted me when I first heard it when I was 19. The very last line says, practice resurrection. And that just sounded so weird. Resurrection is a claim, is something to only Jesus did that I heard growing up. So when Wendell talked about it, it's something that we can like cultivate and practice and get good at in our lives, and it's haunted me. And it finally started to make sense to me through prison reentry. And so we're going to spend most of our morning today looking at the DNA or the blueprint of the Lazarus story, where Jesus calls a community to participate and practice in resurrection together as if it were a communal practice, and that what gives rise to it. Now, we're going to pull up the scripture in just a second and look at it, but just does anyone know Jesus' relationship to Lazarus? Lazarus is our quintessential person in the tombs. Someone who is in the realm of the dead in Hades, but who has a name. What's Jesus' relationship to Lazarus?
Friend.
Bingo. So we're going to use the F word a lot today. Friendship is key. And so this is what got me into it. I did not do studies and reentry studies. I didn't feel it was a course in seminary or in social work studies. I learned about reentry because my buddies were in there. And I got tired of seeing them hit these barriers coming home, and I wanted to go fishing with them, like I get to now. I wanted to go have coffee with Alex, because we met in the tombs, and God connected our hearts, and there were tears and laughter in these solitary cells and visiting rooms. How do I get my buddies back? So when I learned how many barriers there were, that oftentimes change didn't happen on the streets, but it was when I was writing letters with guys in solitary confinement that the fellowship continued while they were still in the realm of the dead. And the friendship and the trust developed in a two-way. And so I want to offer to you, before we even look at the scripture, and I'm going to invite Alex to come up right now, is that the beginning of the Lazarus story, Jesus didn't even have like a strategic plan. Okay, here's how we're going to do resurrection across all the land. But his buddy died. His buddy, his friend was in the tombs. And we often quote the one time, the shortest verse in the Bible is, that moment is right here. And that's where we're going to begin today. Is that the heart of God is broken. When you love someone who's on the other side of the gates of Hades, when you love someone in the tombs, the heart refuses to normalize it. Well, people die. You can tell that to someone whose loved one is dead? You're going to tell that to someone who has a loved one in prison? Well, we got to have prisons. When you have a loved one in there, the whole system is under question. And you will do everything you can. Love will do everything it can to claw through the gates and find a way to remove the barriers and connect with the beloved. And so I think this is our call. And that's why the Lazarus story is the template. It's that the friendship of God with those who are in the tombs is what ignites resurrection and calls a community together. Say friendship.
Friendship.
Alex, come on up and tell us how the friendship of God and the friendship with the community was part of your awakening still inside the solitary tombs.
Well, I think it started with you, Chris. Even while I went away, you continue to write me letters, send me little funny postcards, and we stayed in contact. I would call you once in a while. And so even though I was still lost in my ways and lost in the darkness in the tombs while I was in there, in and out of solitary confinement, getting shipped from the peninsula to eastern Washington and back and forth, I knew I could always count on Chris. I had him. So in the beginning of 2019, when I decided, all right, I no longer feel what I'm doing is right in my heart, and I decided to change. So my first step was in prison. I separated myself from the gangs. And that was the hardest decision I had ever made, because that's all I knew. So I felt like I betrayed everything I ever knew since a little kid. And I cried. I sat in solitary confinement and I cried. I didn't know who I was. I was scared. I was like, all right, what do I do now? Am I going to get a fit in? Am I going to fit in? Am I going to get rejected? did I make the right decision? And so I sat there with my silence and my silence and in darkness, but a different kind of darkness. Because I was in a dark cell, but now I had light in my heart. And so I said, all right. Well, I got Chris. I got my older brother, Renato, who had recently just changed his life. And who is now a youth mentor and works with the gang affected in our community. So I called Chris. I said, Chris, well, first I called my brother and I said, hey, you're probably going to be mad at me. He's like, what for? I said, well, I cut ties with the gang. He said, I love you. He said, that's the best thing you could have ever done. And he's like, I will never reject you. I'm here for you. And so Chris was the second person I called, and Chris said, all right, where do we go from here? You're going to have these barriers when you get out. And guess what? I'm going to be here for you. And so I got happy. I was like, so you're saying you're gonna walk with me? You're going to ride with me? And he's like, yeah, I'm going to be there for you. We're all going to be here for you. So
that's Alex's brother, Renato.
For me, that's my brother right there. This is Ramon. He was one of my reentry guys. So I got out, and Chris was right there. It's all right. Let's go get your license. Let's go find a job. Let's take care of child support. Whatever you need to do, those are the barriers that's going to weigh you down. Because a lot of people don't have that. And they get out, and those barriers are just overwhelming. Even going to the grocery store, and as soon as I hit the ice cream aisle, I got overwhelmed. That's way too much choices. I had to walk out. That was overwhelming for me. So I thank God for the relationship that I have with Chris. And communication, and I always knew I had him right there. And so I just thank you for being there.
You're welcome, man.
Want to hug now, or?
How many of y'all have gone to a foreign country and felt completely lost? Like you didn't have someone pick you up at the airport? And you didn't speak the language? Nobody? Okay, no one picked you up at the airport and you did not speak the language. How did you feel?
Vulnerable, scared.
Okay. Any other feelings? Vulnerable, scared? Even folks that have a decent amount of some mobility and some confidence and some education, as soon as you step into another environment, where do I go? What do I do? All right. And so this is the beginning to imagine of folks getting out of prison. They've often have existed outside the actual prison. But to actually, if someone's coming awake, they're coming alive inside prison. I want to do good. Essentially, whether they're coming awake in a religious program, they're having experience with God, they're just having some kind of awakening or healing or maturity, and they want to change their lives. Oftentimes, folks coming out of prison, they've still never entered the land of the living in terms of the civic participation in America. They've oftentimes already lived in a kind of underworld, an underground economy, drug dealing, not having one's papers, not having a driver's license, crashing with baby mama because you can't get on the rent, on the lease. And so oftentimes folks haven't even participated in the civic society. We have so many barriers that keep people, while we call it underground ministries, there's a kind of underground, I realize. Prison is just the lowest tomb. But even when you get out of, whoa, like that, Sean's mixing it up for us today. This too? Mm. Oh no.
Oh no.
I normally call Eucharist edibles. But I don't think they were that kind of edibles last time. All right, we're back, cool. Or is that underground ministries? Because if prisons are like the actual tombs, buried, even when people are released from prison, there's all sorts of barriers that keep people still in the underground. Does that make sense? So when we're talking about resurrection, it's not just like, well, they get out of prison. A lot of folks have a release date in America. About 80 to 90% of folks in American prisons, they have a release date. But when they're released, we have built so many layers so that they're still in the prison world. They're still in the underground. They never really make it out. So I said this kind of concisely for something I had to write last week, so I'm going to say it here. What do we mean by resurrection? We mean coming back from the dead. Philosopher Lisa Gaither describes the social death of incarceration in America. When you break the law, you're punished by being cut off from your children and loved ones. We talked about that yesterday. cut off from voting and all civic participation. You become a financial burden to any remaining friendship and to the taxpayer. You become a ghost threatening school boards, the felon, the criminals, and real estate developers, should you ever return. You are dead. And the physical and legal walls around the convicted get thicker and thicker. This is what we mean by the gates of Hades. The bodies of the poor are stuffed away and packed in tight like human landfills all across the state. Thankfully, many people in America are now waking up to this nightmare we call mass incarceration. Pop quiz, how many roughly is the number for men and women who are in captivity, incarceration in America? Yeah, we're going down a little bit, which is great. Going down from 2.4 million to about 2.1. We've got a long way to go. Mass incarceration. We have the world's largest criminal punishment system of police, jails, courts, lasting legal charges, and an industry of prisons across the state, with many economic roots needing the continuation of the prisons. And yet, still, over 2 million people, parents, children, siblings, friends, are still locked up in our country. And when someone is finally released from a prison facility, even if they are resolved to live a new life, they're still in a civic underground realm with barriers to ID. You'd think when someone spent years living in a state government institution, they'd step out the door with a state government ID. Yeah, if you wanted to do like a single case study to talk about a system that's meant to not help have people return to society, it's like if you lived in the Department of Licensing for 20 years, and when you left, you did not have a license from the Department of Licensing. This is no accident. Without a driver's license, without employment, and community embrace, they're locked out of the land of the living, so they go back to the old relationships in the streets, because we're relational beings. Just to survive the shadows and patterns that often led them back to jail and prison again. So friends, the tombs are full. The underground realm of unwanted lives swells beneath the surface of community in America, where men and women with criminal records quickly get arrested and go back to the tombs again. It's a death loop back to the tombs. We need a resurrection movement. We need what Wendell Berry was talking about. We need resurrection, the people that believe in it and sing about it and claim about it and preach about it and go to seminary and argue about it. Sounds great. We need to learn how to make resurrection a practice. And so that's what we're going to try to explore here today.
A little follow-up on that, Chris, is also just to note that legally in the state of Washington, they are you're required to go back to where you originated from, like right. where you were originally arrested from, because of past issues of Tacoma, for example, being used as a dumping ground. Legislation was passed such that even if your support network and your healthier options might be somewhere else, you were required to go back to where you were originally picked up.
Yep.
Which is not necessarily helpful for someone's, you know, return.
Right, so this is part of the underground we're talking about. Even though you're released from the physical tomb of a lockdown facility, you are still in a civic netherworld, oftentimes maintained, policed, and controlled by the Department of Corrections. And so we talked about relationships as part of resurrection. So this is our mission statement, Underground Ministries. Someone want to read it out loud?
Underground Ministries opens new relationships of embrace and trust between the incarcerated and the communities into which they return for our mutual transformation and resurrection.
There we go. So our mission statement is not we help the incarcerated. It's not we empower the incarcerated. Our key verb is we open new relationships. Because of mass incarceration is mass disconnection. We want to be in the business of creating a department of connections. Joan.
Okay, I worked in a public library for 30 years. You can go, we don't know what we can do. Go to your public library and say, what services do you offer for people who have been incarcerated? Have them make up packets of information. Because oftentimes we have people coming out back to their communities, they don't have anything. They come to the library because somehow it's in our genetic, they know where to go. Go to your librarians, write letters, write to the directors, ask them to have packets to help people get, you know, how do you get a phone? Get them online. How do you get your driver's license? There are staff that are waiting to help the individual. there are people in their community, but that we have people who come to homeless. We get them back on their feet. But you need to encourage them. You say, why don't you have this? I need you to have this ready to go. Have an information sheet, a packet ready to go. So here's where you go. They can easily do it. They can have something on the internet for them. But push on. And you can do that.
Thank you, Joan. And hopefully by the end of this session this morning, we will be able to push our churches. And we have a program with all of the resources that a church can say yes. And we walk a church through every single step of having every single resource and more that Joan just asked for. Because I'd love it if the libraries can be pushed and can engage, but even more the communities that claim to believe in the resurrection. I want to make sure these communities are equipped everywhere in every county in America. So here's where One Perishable Prisoner came into being. When the book was out and we were traveling around, oftentimes there's the Q&A at the end. And after people hear about these inspiring stories of gang members changing their lives in the Northwest, that's great. Someone raises their hand and says, what can we do? And I didn't have a good answer for a long time. I don't know, sign up for our newsletter, help us grow, become a donor, which is great. We still hope you sign up for our newsletter. It'd be great if you can join us. But then one woman named Mary at an Episcopal church, and we still can't find her now. And so it's kind of like one of those Hallmark movies. We can't find Mary. But Mary gave me a typed up little prospectus. It was very poorly typed and like looked like it was in DOS, an old courier. And it said, OPOP, One Parish, One Prisoner. In Washington State, there's roughly the same amount of churches as are incarcerated men and women. And that just really got me thinking. Rather than relying on one or two or three inspiring and top-heavy nonprofits in a few urban centers who already, even if we all donated to them, couldn't bear the load, but people are going home all over the state. But there's churches everywhere. What if every church was in relationship with one person coming home? There's enough resources there to find rentals. It's all through relationships, Department of Connections. If you plug into a church, you've got lawyers, you've got landlords, you've got grandmas, you've got childcare, you've got what are they called? Potlucks, meal trains. You've got folks that can write letters. You've got folks across different generations. What if an entire community, even if it's small, the small churches are actually the best. What if every church was in relationship with one person? We could empty the prison system. We could have a mass resurrection movement. And I think it would change every church. Maybe this would begin to create the power of proximity that we talked about on the first day that Brian Stevenson says is the key first ingredient for approaching mass incarceration. If there's a distanciation, as Dan was giving us that word on the first day, there's this distancing that creates the problems. And we can even bury our social ills in our human trash. But the power of proximity says, I love this person. There's kinship here. Kinship so quickly. As Father Greg Boyle talks about, when we can create that proximity, not just with a few inspiring nonprofits, but what if every church could do this, we would just need to get them started. And so I started pitching this idea at the Q&A whenever we'd be at a bookstore or a seminary or a talk somewhere, and I've always assumed that people would be like, ugh, no, and they'd say, what can we do? I said, what about this one person prisoner idea? And I thought people would be like, yeah, no. Everybody came afterwards. They said, where do we sign up? I said, oh, it's just an idea. We don't have a program. 7 years later, we've got a program. So embrace and trust is the key. There's the number of churches, the number of incarcerated people as we're talking about. That just got us thinking. We need all hands on deck. Alex.
Yeah.
Oh, you're standing up. I thought you were ready to deliver.
I want to see Paul.
You want to see Paul? All right, so this is Paul Fuentes. Paul Fuentes just came home with St. Paul's Episcopal across the street from us in Mount Vernon. We started with three, a little Methodist church, a medium kind of suburban Presbyterian church, and a large Jesuit cathedral downtown Seattle. We wanted to try different denominations. We piloted it for a few years. We had no learning modules. We paired them with someone coming home to their area within a year or two, and we gave them what we felt was our pretty inspiring introduction, and it was not good. That after a month or so, no one was writing letters. And the incarcerated folks were writing back to me being like, hey, what's up? We're doing this or what? Yeah, like, aren't you guys writing letters? Nah, I mean, I got a few cool letters like a month or so ago, and I think when you guys had orientation or some shit, like I don't know, I haven't heard from anybody. I'm like, what? So I'm trying to reach out to people. They're like, yeah, I got kind of busy. I wasn't sure what to write in my letter, and so I thought, oh wow, we've got a lot of work to do. Of just like, how do we write a letter? So I put a little web page together and I sent out to folks like, here's some ideas about how to write a letter. And folks are like, great, do you have more of these? So then that became the first of what now 25 monthly learning modules that guide teams through 2 years of this journey we're going to talk about today. So Paul benefited through, now we, those are the first three pilots we learned about. We have 35 parishes in Washington State now. We're starting in Chicago currently this summer. And Paul just came home and his team helped contact his dad. And that was his first embrace with his dad in 18 years. So this picture was about 2 minutes out. He just exited those gates right behind the Rubicon. All right, so as I said, Lazarus is our blueprint for this story, where it begins with friendship. This is Jesus's friend. And friendship is the power. Friendship is the fuel that says, all right, I'm going to organize people. We're going to roll away the stone. I'm going to reverse the process of death. And this was my fuel as well. I got into reentry because Alex and so many guys were my friends. And then they had so many friends in prison that we couldn't serve them all. So that's why we needed this even to pilot in Washington. We need more hands on deck. We need more churches to love and walk with someone. So that's Philip. Philip came home a year ago, and his team is really great. Here's another image of the resurrection that I really like. It's one of my favorites. One of my coworkers, Alvin, he pointed out as we're kind of scouring Google Images for the last few years for all sorts of images from Italian Renaissance, from grottos, or Giotto's frescoes, to paintings like these, that there's very different emotions in the community. See the difference?
Yeah.
What do you see? What's the difference?
That one looks like whispering white people, like wasps. They're like, Jesus, what's happening? But the other one is just like, yes.
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
There's joy in one, and I see pissed off people in the other.
What do you think there's more of in our country? Yeah, I think both are happening. I like that these shed, that there's different communities probably in Jesus' time. Right, so there's a lot of fear. And I think this depicts the attitude, even in churches, around the folks coming home from prison, as if they were mummies, as if they were felons, they were just urchins crawling out of the underground, as opposed to, this is our beloved who's been restored to us. This is an act of celebration and gathering. And so what we're trying to do with one person in prison is create a cultural shift. From this is the American attitude towards incarceration and release, to this. Oh, there's Wally with our Burlington Lutheran. Pastor. Who knows Pastor Scherers? Apparently everyone knows each other in the Northwest Center. So here's our story. Would anyone like to read this slowly?
Can you go back one slide?
Yes, sir.
That's Kathleen Hasselblad. I'm sorry.
No problem. Alex, can you read this passage for us? The gospel... The Lazarus passage is one of the longest stories outside of the Passion narrative in all the Gospel narratives. If you ever try to read the whole thing, it's long. So this is the kind of moment we select, but almost all of John 11. So if a story takes a long time in one of the Gospel narratives, it's probably pretty important. This is a long DNA or blueprint for practicing resurrection. Alex.
Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you would always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go."
All right, so much here. So if this is our blueprint, we began with being deeply moved, being grieved. As Paul and Dan have been sharing in their series this week, which I missed yesterday, that grief is essential. Grief is the beginning. Our hearts being moved is the beginning of this work, as opposed to just a topic we learn about or watch documentaries about. We add it to our list of many injustices that we can quote. when we're moved, when we weep, when we know someone on the other side, that's the first part of what we're doing with One Parish, One Prisoner. So we're inviting people to approach the tombs. Even the sign-up process we call approaching the tombs, even registering and getting involved is a process of approach. And then when we pair them with someone who's returning to their area, releasing in about a year or so, because that's key, we want to create a full year of relationship building and trust building. If Alex would have just said, well, when I got out, I want to do good, it's already too late. But he needs a whole year ahead of time to plan his release and build a community and to build years of we had years to build a relationship.
Well, I think I needed about 16 years with you. Chris would, when I was out and doing bad, he would go find me. He didn't care where I was. It didn't scare him. He would go look for me.
Oh, man. You can see why priests aren't supposed to have families and kids, because there's no way I could have been running around late night and crawling through trailer windows and driving to prison on the side of the state with my family and kids.
I'd hear knock at the door and I'd be like, shit, it's Chris.
So that's the first part. And then Jesus says, roll away the stone. Now, was the stone a natural phenomenon? How did the stone get there? What is the stone?
That was like the door, but they didn't really have doors, so they used rocks.
Okay.
Humans placed it there.
Humans placed it there. This is essential. This is a heavy structural barrier that was shaped and carved and put there with the whole entire community's consent. It's not like everyone's saying, oh no, why are you putting the stone there? And just the Romans were placing it. Every community has a way of creating heavy barriers between the realm of the dead and us. Right? And so when Jesus says, roll that away, is that good news to most folks?
No.
No. Even someone said what? Lord, by this time, there's going to be... It's going to stink. And so for me, I kind of hear this, if this is our blueprint, as this is the stand-in question for every question about, yeah, what about? What about the children if we start welcoming people home from prison? What about sex offenses? What about... Give me some more.
What about somebody who still is stealing?
Okay.
Like, what if you welcome somebody who's still stealing?
Yeah, they have theft on the record. What if they start stealing again? What if they steal from me?
Yeah.
What else?
Look at his face. Look at all the tattoos on that face.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Scary.
Yeah.
Scary.
If he has violent charges, what if he hurts us? What else?
There goes the neighborhood.
How so? that holds a lot. But what do you think people mean when they say that?
I think that they mean that they will no longer feel safe in their nice, safe neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
their nice, safe streets, and their...
And safe as code for?
White.
Yep.
The value of your property will go down.
Yep.
Hey, Chris.
Yes, sir.
On the example you're just using there, I think it's even doubly important to point out that the concern about the odor is being brought up by his sister.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you were talking about people's responses, I mean, this is family. This is mm-hmm. loved one. This is
mm-hmm.
one who you would think in the moment would be supportive and excited and on board, and yet even there is resistance.
Right. We have many learning modules, and this is an entire one that takes up like a week of learning. But I'll touch on this really quickly, that there's been, it would be an understandable question when we do One Parish, One Prisoner, to be like, well, how presumptuous is this to have like some church community work with them rather than their family? That oftentimes the folks applying said, my family, it's a little complicated. Can anyone relate to that? If you've got a problem, or like, hey, would you just go to your family? It's a little complicated. Sometimes it's nice to have a fresh start with new community members. Secondly, while we're on it, when we do One Parish, One Prisoner, the goal is not, we state it both to our incarcerated applicants as well as our church applicants, the goal is not to get them to come to church. And it's explicitly said at the beginning, we've had folks who are even practicing Satanists apply, and we're like, are you open to building relationships of trust and embrace with our new community folks? They happen to all go to the same church. And if you're down, let's rock. And same to the church. Like, you know, they might go to a different church. Like this guy, Philip, that just came home, he was stated atheist and participated with kind of pagan classes in groups on the inside. And he said, I'd like to do this with this church. These Presbyterians are really cool. They're not like, you know, Bible thumping me. But by the end, he said, I want to go to this church. I don't know if I'm a Christian yet, But I want my family to be around you good people. I thought all Christians sucked, but you guys are cool and I want to be part of your community. And then last month he confessed, he called me in the morning, he's like, can you come to my baptism tonight? Like, bro, we talked last week, what happened? He's just like, long story, just come to my baptism. But it turns out that he was being baptized at a different church, this super red state cowboy church place that he went, and this is a PCUSA congregation that normally wouldn't go to cowboy church. But he works with these guys in the union, and he was slipping into some old patterns and recognized that he was powerless, and he said, I need to surrender to God. And his coworker said, come to our church and get baptized tonight. He said, fuck it. Sorry, this is the language of the tombs that I enjoy. And so he says, come, and then his church comes. And so I love it. They didn't say, you need to be a Christian, you need to play along with Bible talk to get some services, which is oftentimes the exchange with religious programming. They just loved him. And something else is happening, and it even got them to go be part of a church they don't want to be a part of. And so I love the way the resurrection does not always go according to our plan as we let go of control. This is what I want to step on right now, is that when this question is asked, and we opened it up to all the different questions that we asked, that Jesus doesn't say, you're right, odor. We need to put an odor management committee together, and we'll discern that through our council, and we'll get back to you next month. Thank you so much for that question. We need to really stop and spend some discernment time around this idea. What's that?
Is that even in our bylaws that we can do
that? Right. And so this is, I like that Jesus doesn't even say, he doesn't even affirm the what if, which is challenging. What is Jesus' response? It's right here.
If you believe.
Someone can say it out loud.
They'll see the glory of God.
Yep. They'll see the glory of God. Dan quoted on the first day, Irenaeus' famous and wonderful quote, that the glory of God is seen in human person fully alive. And man, when you see someone coming back from the dead, you see it. And I didn't have the language for it for years. I was hooked on going into the jails and the prisons and seeing people come alive. I was seeing the glory of God. It wasn't some abstract, shimmery feeling when I had my hands raised in church, as I tried to do so hard for decades. But it was where Jesus said it would be. Did I not tell you, even if you step through the mess and the fear, when you see the tombs cracked open, you see someone coming alive, when you see Philip, when you see Alex, when you see these men and women coming alive, you're going to see the glory of God. And I personally, I think churches are dying in America because our generation, the next generation, they're not seeing the glory of God. They're just seeing really nice social clubs. You got Republican social clubs, you got liberal social clubs, but they're just social clubs. People want to see the glory of God. Otherwise, we don't need sermons anymore. We've got podcasts. We don't need a place to have bad coffee and cookies in the morning. We've got social media to connect with people. That's what our church is for. People want to see the glory of God. And I think that's where Jesus is inviting us towards the tombs. And when Jesus invites them to come close, he doesn't say, stand back and watch. And he also doesn't say, you need to raise the dead. So we as churches doing One Perishable Prisoner, we are not the ones raising the dead. We are participating with Jesus to do what? What are the two things he invites them to do?
Roll away the stone.
Roll away the stone.
And unbind him.
Unbinding. Okay, so for Underground Ministries, our work is based on these three things. Friendship in the tombs first. We spend a lot of time entering the tombs, either through programming if we can, but a lot of it is through letters and phone calls. Does anyone here miss writing letters? Paper. You know, back when you're like, you know, falling in love as a teenager, writing long letters, or then, you know, maybe for my generation, Gmail and... and Hotmail was out, you start writing long emails back and forth. Oh, they're so good. Prison relationships are a way to enter that magic again. Letters, friendships in the tomb, and then rolling away the stones. So for us, rolling away the stones are the structural barriers. And for us, unbinding the layers, these are the personal layers. Protective mechanisms, you could call them. We're going to go into an examples, as well as if anyone's familiar with like the contemplative spirituality and Thomas Merton, folks that led to Thomas Merton, about revealing the true self. And we all have layers of the false self, even if they're not meth addiction or hardcore misogyny or gang involvement, that we all have layers. And part of it is discovering together what's underneath. And Jesus, while Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, Jesus does not say, okay, it's on you. Go live a good life. Prove it. He invites a community to roll away those heavy barriers. And he doesn't say, okay, go fix yourself. He invites a community to draw close, and so close that it's an intimate process. It's in relationships that those false layers and protective mechanisms are removed. It's all in relationship. So first, friendship in the tombs, prison letters. I'm going to show a video really quickly. That's still kind of a rough cut. You guys want to see a rough cut?
Sure.
Of some of our one person prisoner participants. And then I'm going to have you, Alex, build on that, if you will. All right. Here it is. So this would be on the second module that when folks start is called The Lost Art of Letter Writing. And this is the video that we'll get at the top. And the color's not graded yet, there's no B-roll.
So when I first heard about One Parish, One Prisoner, I didn't take it serious. I thought, oh, it might happen, it might not. Then I get the first letter from Carol. And then they kept coming the next day. God is doing this for a reason. All this is coming my way for a reason. So, but I'm nervous. I don't want to go anywhere new. But I'm thinking, okay, God is doing all this for me for a reason. If I have faith, then just believe it. So I went all in. They believe is how I believe. And so we have that in common. And from then, that's it.
Okay, so it starts with a letter. And I'll be honest with you, the first thing was, shit, what am I going to say? I don't know this person. And all I could think about was, how do I comfortably start a letter to someone I don't know?
When I got the first letters from these guys who were going to reach out to me, I think I got three in one day, like right off the bat. And I remember I took these letters with me to my cell. I'm reading these letters, and this is, they were introducing themselves. And again, man, I was like, whoa. I hadn't had a letter from anybody in a long time.
I remember my first letter that I was composing, and it felt like every word was a ton of bricks to just get on the page. I was at a lot of fear that this person who had no idea who I was, where I was coming from, my context, I was worried that this would not be received well. He returned a letter to me, and we found out that we both ran the same streets in a way in Northeast Seattle, that we were raised by single moms with two sisters, and that we both had boys. There was so much common ground right away.
I want you to remember that the person you're writing to
is more likely
experiencing the same thing, the same emotions you're experiencing. You've got nerves about what you write. So do we. You don't know how they're going to think of you. I don't either. You're afraid of being judged, etc. Like, just remember that more likely than not, you're not the only person feeling what you're feeling. We especially, it's hyper. I'm hyper aware of everybody's emotions around me. Because I have to be.
It was definitely not a relationship that I was expecting to blossom the way it has. I would say he's very close to my best friend.
We had our kickoff orientation, and that very afternoon, I wrote my first letter. And I decided that, you know, I could spend a lot of months just telling Paul a little bit of this and a little bit of that, or I could be absolutely vulnerable and just put it all out there. His first letter was amazing because it said, thank you for deciding to do this and looking past that stigma of a prisoner. It was just fun to watch him bloom and to start telling not just things from the past, but about his daily life, what it was like to be in prison.
To this day, the people in my team that I'm closest with were the two people whose letters immediately grabbed me. And what grabbed me about their letters were that when they wrote their letters as a human being. They were just human. It wasn't scripted, it wasn't a crafted letter. It was a letter of saying, this is where I grew up, this is where I live, this is what I enjoy doing. Immediately that grabbed me, because it's just like, here's a guy that's no different than me, and I am no different than him.
Quantity certainly isn't the goal. Quality. Uh-huh. And it doesn't have to be perfect grammar or well thought out, well written. Just heartfelt, you know. Speak from your heart as you were speaking to a true friend, as you were wanting to know more about them, reveal more about yourself as well.
These things we would talk about, you don't talk about with the ladies at church and the, you know, Bible study. You don't get that, you don't dig down that deep. And when somebody shares things with you that are so personal and so deep in his mind, you want to share back.
I mean, it was just such little things, but it was those little things that got me up the next day to make my bed, to go down to lunch, to be able to go to sleep at night knowing that I could wake up the next day because I was going to get another letter.
When you get your hopes up and you're waiting for that letter, you're merely existing in there. Like, you're standing at the door 3 hours before the mail guy comes, and you're sitting there. You got this anxiety, you got this, or am I gonna be let down? Is my day gonna go sideways? And you're waiting there for a letter, and 90% of the time the letter never comes.
The entire prison sentence is a mind game, like with yourself. Like, am I going crazy? No, I'm crazy. No, I'm not crazy. Wait, did that life exist? Do I exist? Wait. Then you get that letter and you're like, no. Yeah. That was me. This is me. I'm okay. Like, any piece of the outside world of like recognition that like you're still alive, like that's why letter writing is like everything.
The best kind of letters are the ones that you don't expect when you're in a dark place and somebody writes you and brings up some awesome memories. When somebody brings up, hey, remember this? You're still this person. You're still this awesome guy. I guess in a sense, somebody's reminding you that you're not done for. It's not over. You still got that light inside of you that shines bright.
Hey, Chris.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Tag, something on it?
Yeah.
One, that was awesome. Two, I'm a chronic overthinker. That's just how I function. That's how I dysfunction, really.
What's in the margin?
Is I tend to overthink. And I think one of the most humbling and amazing experiences that I've had doing Living Stones that ties directly into this video is the power in the simplicity of that presence and of that relationship. Like, it's almost embarrassing how simple it is, that what matters is things like going in and being face to face and treating that person as a person and recognizing their humanity. And it's such a freaking low bar in some regards. You know, and it's like listening to this video and these things about these letters and the power of that, because it's that reminder to an individual that they still matter, that they have not been forgotten. I think one of the things I hear all the time from my guys is that recurring theme of that being probably the single biggest fear of being forgotten, of no longer, in a sense, of no longer existing. And there's something freeing in recognizing how deceptively easy it is to start being involved, how deceptively simple it is to actually make a tangible difference, that it doesn't require degrees and it doesn't require some sort of expansive knowledge and experience and whatnot. It's literally the basic work of being human with another human being.
Amen.
Like, that's where it starts.
And so tomorrow we're going to workshop, and we're going to whiteboard it up, and we're going to engage thinking about all different ways that we can bring the heavenly realities of Holden Village into prisons. Weaving, baking, pottery, creative writing, liberation theology, eco-justice groups, gardening groups. Let's fill that place. Let's invade the Hades with these heavenly realities. And so we're going to talk about that, as well as if you are part of a community that wants to do reentry and resurrection with one perishable prisoner template. We're going to workshop that tomorrow to step in exactly what Chris is saying. We can do this. This is our gig. We're just, we need to take it somewhere that way. Alex, I'm going to talk about stones for a sec and then pass it to you to help illustrate that. Sure. So the first part is friendship with the tombs. And letters is how we do that, because once there's that connection, you'll do anything for someone that you know and you love. It's not just the incarcerated. It's not Paul. It's not Tatiana. This is a person I know and I love, and I've been writing with this person. It's manageable. I'm with the team. And secondly, if you're on the incarcerated side, they have no reason to trust some church or strangers to help them or take them to appointments when they get out, unless they've been writing for a year. We've been doing some visits, and you came and you drove across the state to this landfill where I've been stuffed in visiting me. So we need a year of building relationship and trust. But then, starting to roll away the stones. Structural barriers. So stones is the metaphor in the Lazarus booklet, just structural barriers to reentry. What do we mean by that? There are so many courts folks oftentimes have. It's not just the superior court, often, in the county seat, where they had to get locked up and go before a larger judge in a black robe, or if there's a crime that was large enough to get sent off and sentenced to prison. But there's so many little municipal courts, city courts. There's all sorts of smaller courts they didn't go to prison for. But they've been all racking up FTAs, failures to appears. And so when you come out, they still have all these warrants. You think that'd be cleared. Oh no, you get out of prison, you've got warrants waiting for you the day. You step out of those prison gates, you've got active warrants still waiting for you. Why wouldn't they clear those? I paid my debt to society. No, that's a myth.
They grab them up sometimes too.
We got legal debt, LFOs. Alex, what does LFO stand for?
Legal financial obligations. So
walk us through all that list in your situation.
While you're in prison, you're racking up a debt. They charge you for being there.
Really?
Yeah. Charge you for being there. And all kinds of other fines. So we got this form called, it's a process called Stones and Layers. And remember when Chris mailed it to me and I filled it out, and it was scary. I said, there's no way I'm going to do anything on this form. Stones being the barriers. And then layers being what's inside. And the way, when I work with, I don't want to call my clients, when I work with my buddies now, because I do reentry, I look at layers like their heart is like an onion. And I love taking the layers out their heart, because I see them open up. So, I mean, I filled out my paper, it was the scariest thing in the world, and mine was jam-packed, and Chris pulled it out in December, and he said, remember this? Folder like that, with letters. And that paper was in there. He's like, remember this? And I was like, yeah. He's like, well, you conquered it. And I had never seen it like that. And he pulled it out. And, you know, I took care of everything on there. Right now, my LFOs, I got about 70% of it forgiven for. And so these are barriers that's going to stop somebody from wanting to live right, or want them to go ahead out. And for me, the main one is driver's license.
Why?
Because there's so many things in the way from getting the driver's license, so many holes and whatnot, and guys just get discouraged. They're like, well, I'm going to drive anyways. My baby's mom got me a car, or my friend got me a car, or somebody's letting me borrow a car. And if you're driving without a driver's license, in your head, you're already breaking one rule. So what is it to break the next rule? So that's the main one right there for me. I mean, in my eyes.
Any guess what the number one offense is for recidivism? Make people go back into the legal system in America?
Driving without a license.
Yeah. It's not violence. It's not theft. It's not drug use. It's driving with license suspended in the third. It's the number one thing to put people right back into the system. So all those LFOs Alex was talking about, if you don't have your fines paid off, you have a hold and you can't get your license.
It could be hundreds and hundreds.
Right. And so folks can't, they're already driving dirty, so to say, to even get to their job if they get a job. And so we've learned how, and we teach the teams how to crack this code and go write letters to judges and get small payment plans going, which lift the hold. You don't have to pay it all off. And then they get the ball. They don't tell people that when they get out of prison. No.
Well, and while you're inside, if you are, if you're lucky in some ways, you might be able to find employment. But just because you want a job while you are incarcerated doesn't mean there is one for you to have. There's only so many going around. And even if you do have one, for example, the last 5 months I just spent serving as the de facto chaplain at one of our sites. So I had to, one of the prisons in the state, so I was signing off on time cards. You know, how much do you think those guys make an hour? It's 42 cents.
Yeah.
It's 42 cents an hour. But even then, it was capped because they can't earn more than $55 a month.
You guys remember? Oh, sorry.
So, like, there is literally no way to work off this debt while you're inside. It's functionally impossible. If you're really, quote, lucky, you might be able to get one of the higher paid jobs. And by higher paid, I mean, like, maybe $1.25, $1.50, working for something called Correctional Industries, which is a public-private partnership that is its own layer of toxic we can talk about later. But they do things like making furniture for our local schools and things with inmate labor.
How many of you guys remember Sam? He's African-American gentleman in our video the first day who was doing the coffee roasting, packing, and bagging. So Sam drove forklift at three different prisons for 12 years. He was like the chief who ran the operations. When he got out, he couldn't get a forklift job anywhere. Even Goodwill. There's a forklift position at Goodwill, and Goodwill wouldn't hire him because of his record. This is what we're dealing with. This is the underground. So Alex, go ahead with describing which of those stones, how they applied in your reentry journey.
Courts. I was done with courts by the time I got out. Legal debt, LFOs. I had 5 different cases dating all the way back to 2007. The first time I got out of prison when I learned about LFOs, I was getting these letters and I was like, what's this? And so I went to the court clerk and I was like, what do you mean I gotta pay for my incarceration? She said, yeah. I was like, well, I can't pay this, too much. She said, well, you shouldn't have gone to prison. That was that. So I mean, so I went to prison for 14 months, got out. I was out for 4 months and caught 120 months. I didn't have no direction. I didn't have nobody. I wasn't accepting Chris in the way that I should have. But so when I got out this time, I called the LFO place and I was, or the county clerk, and I was like, all right, I got a job. I had just got married. Chris officiated her wedding. I see her. Got married in front of a lot of the church. So, I was financially stable. I was like, all right, I'm going to start doing this. So I called and I was like, well, I'm ready to pay on this one that you sent me. They're like, yeah, there's 4 more. And on one of them, I owed $12,000, on another one, $5,000, on another one, $6,000. But I was like, all right, well, it's possible. We've got to start somewhere. So I said, well, and her name was Cookie, the lady I was talking to. She's like, yeah, my name's Cookie. And I was like, all right. You got an awesome name. She's like, yeah, well, let's help you. And it's all about communicating, you know. So I was communicating with her, and she's like, well, what can you do? I was like, honestly, I can spare $50 a month. She said, all right, well, $10 on each one. She's like, and you can do $5 on each one. I was like, can I? She's like, yeah, of course. We're here to help. And so I started paying my LFOs, and then we had a, when the prosecutor came over and Andy, so we invited the prosecutor and the assistant attorney over for one of our fellowship gatherings to workshop how to lower LFOs. This was the same prosecutor that put me away. Now we're in the same room sharing a meal, and which was amazing. And so I started being in contact with the assistant attorney, and we put in a motion to the judge, and the judge liked everything he seen. He had actually heard about the work that I was doing, so he's like, yeah, more than qualified. Don't even come into court. And so they knocked off a lot of debt. I only have 3 cases now. One of them went from $8,000 to $500. The other one went from $3,000 to $700. And I think I have one that's $1,200. But I just closed 2 cases. I got 2 cases left. So it's doable. You can do it.
Alex, did it help to be able to start planning this before you release?
Yes, it would have helped.
Yeah.
But it was scary. I was waiting for the $10 my sister was sending me every 2 weeks, so I wasn't going to give that to them.
Excuse me. Who did you say Cookie? What department or who was Cookie?
That was in my running. She's no longer there anymore.
What department member?
Yeah. The county clerk. So she's the one that first.
Yeah, and it was.
I hope that you could do a little bit.
Yeah, and it was over a phone call during my lunch break at work. I called and she was just this nice person and she was there to help. Ramon, a guy on our team, had already been in contact with her helping other guys coming out, so she already knew about Underground and about the process. So, building relationships. That's where it starts, building relationships. My probation officer, I've been on probation for a year and a half. I still go visit him. He's like, what are you doing here? I was like, I'm coming to visit you. Get over it, you know? And I got his personal phone number, and, you know, I keep those relationships. We have softball games, and the cops who used to arrest me, I invite them to softball games. They come over. Not only do they come over with their uniform. They bring their kids and their family. So, I mean, there's fines, there's driver's license, getting the job. And with getting the job is crucial, too. Like, you don't always want to start full-time. It could get overwhelming. You still got all these other stones you're dealing with. So I started part-time. I started part-time, and while I was tackling each and every one of these, eventually went to halftime, and then went to full-time, where it got easier. Because if you're working full-time, and you're trying to do all this, you're going to get overwhelmed.
Alex, what happens when people finally get a job, and they get their driver's license, they show up, and they go to work, and they got their boots, and then they get their first check?
And they can go to the drive-thru later night.
when half of your check is missing.
When half of your check is, child support. So child support comes in, they take most of it. So I've learned how to through Chris, how to I ignored child support for forever. I was like, I just started working, I don't want them to take my money. And Chris is like, you gotta get a hold of him, he's persistent. And then finally, I was like, right, I'm ready. Let's call child support. We call child support, and they're like, we've been taking money from you. I didn't even notice, because I didn't owe that much. And so they're like, we've been taking it from you. Haven't you noticed? I said, I didn't notice, but can we lower it? Yeah. And they work with me. They're still working with me. I still owe child support. It's part of the process. But when guys, there's some guys that aren't that fortunate, and child support is taking most of their money. So learning how to communicate with child support, and it's so now I help guys because I got the number from Chris, which was hard to find for me. He found it right away. He just looked it up online. I didn't know how to use a phone. So I help guys lower their child support payments, which makes it easier for them to have some kind of income so they could pay rent or whatnot, put gas in their car, treatment facilities. We recommend that if guys do have struggled with addiction in the past and they're vulnerable to it, that they do at least some kind of chemical dependency screening. I had to do it. I didn't want to do it. I felt as all right, I've already been gone for a decade. Why do I need to do this? And so I did it. It was part of my journey, and I did my screening over the phone, and the guy said, yeah, you don't need it. You're fine. So it's scary, but it can be done. Housing, when me and Angie moved from my mom's garage into our house, Chris wrote an awesome letter for us in support, and I didn't have no problem getting housing. There's guys where they'll get rejected for housing.
Why?
Part of it's subsidized housing through federal programs, mm-hmm. and others. You can't be in those with a criminal record.
Yep.
No. So those are closed to you. Mm-hmm.
So these are just some examples. This is just, honestly, just a portion of the barriers to reentry. So when you add them all together, this is what it means for us to roll away the stone. They're not coordinated, these offices. There's not like a forum. There's not agencies that work together. Now, when you go into the tombs, they all work together, right? The judge hits flush, and that whole system, it sucks you right down, and you don't need to be like, hey, how do I get into the prison? Can someone help me? They take you right in, and all systems are coordinated to get you in there. But when you're coming out, I have a master's degree, and it's taken me a decade to figure this out, to find my way through the gauntlet of these reentry barriers. And so what we're trying to do now with One Parish, One Prisoner is create, through these learning modules, kind of like a step-by-step reentry for dummies with links and everything right there online, so that really anyone can do it. It takes a long time to figure out, but we've all put it together so that communities can say, with their person coming on, what Alex does full-time now, which is what we call a reentry navigator, to navigate the system.
So now they're doing, we got an assistant attorney, and now there's ways to vacate your felonies, get rid of the felonies. It's just a matter of how long you've been off probation and what the felony is. But, I mean, there's guys who don't have that much serious felonies, who they can get it all wiped off. So there's that to look into also.
So Alex, let's move to layers next.
Layers?
And remember, this is resurrection work. When Jesus invited the community to roll away the stones, do you think that felt very spiritual? Do you think it felt inspiring to roll away this big, heavy stone? Someone rolled away like a huge boulder?
Heavy.
Yeah, you probably get hurt a little bit. You get exhausted. This isn't fun. I hate this stuff. But you do it when you love someone, right? And so what we want to do is help communities see that this is, we hear who will roll away the stone, we're rolling away the stone language. This is what it can look like. And that it's heavy work, but this is resurrection work, this stuff in America today.
So I don't understand. What does this mean that you're paying to go to prison? Like, what does that mean? Like
is it legal fees, or is it like they
legal
charge you?
Legal fees, and then they charge you for
like
the amount
room
of time
and board?
You're in prison.
Pretty much.
Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh. And you're in prison, you're racking up this debt. I never had a job in there.
Yep, so distanciation, these costs that we don't want to think about. We don't want to, you know, when every state legislature figures out the budget, even though corrections is oftentimes, corrections and policing are the largest part of any budget of any state. I don't know if there's a state where that's not true.
So this $350 million at Washington, they're paying extra on top of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's expensive. It's a real pork barrel. And so we even have men and women who are in prison who are being charged for their free public defenders. They're being charged legal fees for their court costs. Got that? And then that is added on top of the sentence that they go pay, the felony record, maybe incarceration time, losing their job, losing their family. Then when they get out, that whatever those court costs were,
that's accrued interest.
That started accruing interest the day they stepped into the box.
Wow.
So when Alex, when he quoted those large numbers, that was racking up with interest every year he was in prison. Any guess what was the interest rate?
Higher than anything else, right?
What's the highest housing rate right now? It's bad.
8?
Would you ever want to take a loan out at 8%?
No.
What about 12%?
Cool. No.
It's 12%.
Well, we can't take a loan until his LFOs are paid off anyways.
Bingo. Yeah. And so these are the costs, and then they grow and they grow. These are the stones, the many stones.
Well, and depending on your charges, there's also, there could be mandatory trainings or mandatory programs you have to go through, treatment programs you have to complete before you'll be released. And those programs, they'll charge you for them. But then it's also, I mean, it is mandatory. And so, like for some of them, you know, to use the example, there was some guys who I knew at Twin Rivers, one of the units at Monroe, who they're on the waiting list for the program they have to do in order to be released. Their release date technically was last year, but they are still inside because they haven't been able to do the mandatory treatment program first in order to be released. And then they also have to then pay for that program as part of that. So like, and again, like, I understand that, you know, there might be some benefit to them having this program, but the way it's set up, it's not set up to encourage, you know, quote unquote rehabilitation. It's not set up to encourage some sort of, you know, restoration. It's punitive. It's an additional piece of punishment being layered on top of everything else.
So can I?
Tomorrow we have got a lot of questions, and we hope that you all come back. Please come back, because we're going to both talk about how to get started, as well as we're keeping a list of some questions. Come up and maybe share more. Like, hey, tomorrow make sure we talk about this. And I've got a running list. Sorry, Paul, we got to jump into a few more things. So with layers, remember, there's the two things. There's stones, structural barriers, and layers are personal defense mechanisms, so to say, wrapped around folks coming out of the tombs. Think about, literally, those were bandage layers to preserve bodies in the darkness, right? So how many self-preservation layers we have that end up covering us and tangling us up. Yep. Unbind. So this is where how we can get all bound up. And I love that even Jesus doesn't say, fix that person, change that person, tell them to get their shit together. He doesn't use change, he says unbind. That we're not in the business of changing people. Lazarus is already a beautiful human being, but he's all wrapped up. He's all bound up. People in prison are beautiful people who are very bound up in a lot of these self-preservation mechanisms that destroy and hurt and enslave them as well as people in their communities. But guess what? How many of those would you might think exist in the church? Really? Absolutely. So this is where the mutuality comes into play. Not everyone in churches have structural barriers to their movement through society. But so many folks in church, and I think what I love about Jesus telling the community to unbind them, that when they come close to scary mummy Lazarus, they probably start facing their own stuff, their own fears, their own disgust, their own othering. And they might start, as they start removing it, something I'd like to think of layers are being removed in them. And they start to see Lazarus beneath, hey, you look like my son. This guy, Alex, doesn't look like, hey, gangbanger number one that we need to throw away. That looks like my friend that I met at Holden Village. This is what we're trying to do in removing the layers. One story. She was here this week. She just got on the bus. Named Erin. And she was on video saying this, so I'm not outing her details of her life. She homeschools. She was like, I'm not for this kind of prison stuff. That's what Chris does. But our home church did one parish, one prisoner. And she was really nervous about doing this. She has a lot of anxiety. And that when she started writing letters, though, with a gentleman named Wally, when Wally was coming home, Wally let her know, I've got some really strong mental health diagnoses. And he opened that up to her. And maybe it's because she said in her first letter, hey, I'm not very good at this. I was suicidal for a long part of my life. I was in a mental facility during my 20s for a little bit, or my teen years. I have anxiety attacks. And he was like, no way, me too. What meds are you on? Started talking about the different meds. And he started talking about his diagnoses and hearing voices. She's like, me too. Like, my voices aren't as mean as yours, but they are sometimes, but I also hear them in the woods. And they were talking. Then every Sunday, she looked forward after her church to get a call from Wally. You have a collect call from Wally Cienfuegos. Press 5 to accept, because she had put money on her phone. And she and Wally would have 20 minutes of mental health buddy time. And she loved it way more than all the coffee chatter in the basement and after church. Phone calls with Wally. This is the kinship. We need one another. When Wally can expose the pain in his life and the mental health suffering that he survives, we can recognize we have that too. And folks in churches are dying underneath our layers. I was suffocating under my layers of, everything's okay. Our church is, our family's great. My mom's a teacher, my dad was a missionary, and we are okay. We were not okay. And so going into a jail is where a place where I could take off my just shinier layers, my churchy layers, and where healing could happen for me. So stones are structural barriers. Layers are the interpersonal unbinding. Oh, there's more. Underneath all those layers, domestic violence, shame, trauma, loss. So many wounds, and there's stories to those wounds, and we can begin those in relationships. Sermons can't undo all of that. And there's some good sermons, but we got to have relationships and storytelling processes to start to heal these wounds and reveal our truer selves. So as we tell all of our teams, this is one of the what ifs. What if theft happened, right? And we now have 35 teams, and we can now still say we have yet to report one team. Every team in a church has 5 to 7 people that join the team and go for 2 years in this relationship. We have yet to have one team or even an individual report that they've had a single thing stolen from them or ever felt physically unsafe. But every single team has reported a level of their hearts being broken. So your wallet will not be stolen if you do this work, but your heart will be broken, and that's the bigger risk. And that's where churches start to get really controlling, because we don't want to grieve. We want to succeed. And so a lot of our journey is also helping teams reframe what success is. Because that's often how we can other and it people coming out of prison. It's like, you become our fixing project. Because if you do good, we did good and we all feel better. But we don't know how to die. We don't know how to fail. And we're working with people that are very comfortable with failure. And so a lot of our journey is with one person, one prisoner, is helping churches not only approach the tombs first, like the place of repression and unwantedness in prisons, but then it gets even deeper and you start to love someone. And then this kind of codependent controlling muscle starts flexing in every team where they start telling the person what to do. And we work on that with our welcoming prayer that we read yesterday and we'll close with again today. But I let go of my desire for approval. Society, our church, our family. I let go of my desire for control. Because that's the Department of Corrections. We're the Department of Connections. And that warden God we talk about, that's a controlling deity. And it's a controlling system, the prison system. So we want to let go of that. We understand those muscles in ourselves to control others. So this is a journey of practicing resurrection that we try to invite folks in community into, that this is for our own discipleship as well, spiritual formation. We are not heroes. We're not rescuers. We get to participate in a mutual process so that we see the glory of God. That's Sarah and Joe Ray. Would someone like to read this quote from Father Greg Boyle?
Success and failure ultimately have little to do with living the gospel. Jesus stood with the outcast until they were welcomed, or until he was crucified, whichever came first. I suppose Jesus could have chosen a strategy that worked better, evidence-based outcomes, than in the cross. But he didn't. But he couldn't find a strategy more soaked with fidelity than the one he embraced.
So when Joe Ray got out, he didn't succeed. Joe Ray got out, he had an immense dual diagnosis, complicating challenges he'd had his whole life. Dual diagnosis, mental health challenges, combined with drug addiction, really hard. Add to that, he'd been building relationship with his team for a whole year. This is an in-prison visit. Sarah went, and they built a great relationship. They built a great reentry plan. He got out March 1st, 2020. What happened about a week or two later? Yeah, and so these were very mindful folks, but who were also of retirement age and some immunocompromised. Remember the beginning of the pandemic? We just locked our doors. We didn't know what the hell was going to happen. Joe Ray was down the street in recovery home with nobody. No one could even drive by and pick him up and take him to an appointment, all those appointments we just talked about. So he just sat around a recovery home for about a month or two until they finally called his old girlfriend. Meth is normally how they party, and he was gone. We failed. But only if you say that's the end of the story. They stayed in touch for the next 2 years. Joe Ray's coming home in about 3 more months. So his healing is continuing. He realized, these people still care about me, and I got a taste still of a new way that's possible. And the church realized, oh, it's only failure if we say that's the end of the story. But if we practice faithfulness, what is it, Eugene Peterson that says, obedience in a long direction? So, I'll drop it.
Don't look to me for quotes.
So that if we're faithful over time, we always win. Love wins. It's just how long do you want to play? And if we're faithful and we wait and we go back to the tombs again, we practice resurrection again. It's a practice. Joe Ray isn't great at it, and neither are we. But if we practice together, we practice faithfulness, this is how we see resurrection. We experience and see the glory of God. One last quote before we're going to whiteboard out our plan for tomorrow, where Chris Odie's going to help lead us in that tomorrow. To reveal someone's beauty, this is our goal. Remember Alex, the first day, if we talked about someone saw me. That's the key. It's not just all this work of reentry and rolling away stones. It begins with this. One more person who hasn't spoken today, read this quote from Jean Vanier, who is a very complicated and broken person.
To reveal someone's beauty is to reveal their value by giving them time, attention, and tenderness. To love is not just to do something for them, but to reveal to them their own uniqueness. To tell them that they are special and worthy. We can express this revelation through our own gentle presence in the way we look at and listen to a person, the way we speak to and care for someone. This revelation of value, revelation of their hearts, takes time.
Remember when I talked about the first three teams? They weren't writing letters because they were too
scared.
No?
Scared.
They weren't scared. They were too
busy.
Yeah. Time is our gift. And so I want to suggest looking forward. I mean, the folks that come to Holden Village are like the Navy SEALs of this stuff in America. Time, attention, tenderness, relationship. These are the people we need invading the tombs. If this is the kind of surface of the underground, and the first day we talked about descent into the underground. Chris Oates spent time talking about his work with Living Stones Congregation, where he's going in not just to save souls, but to acknowledge that there's a church, there's a life of Christ in here. And when Chris invites folks to come in, they don't need to come facilitate or lead, they just come and worship. It's radical to just make your commute into the tombs, that this is part of our community, instead of saying you're distant. There's so many ways, I list some off, and we're going to workshop this tomorrow. Think about what you most love doing. Is there a way to do it in a prison near you? I bet you can, especially since COVID cleared out a lot of volunteers that didn't want to get vaxxed. They have a lot of openness for programming. Seriously. And so if you can think about whatever you love, bring in that in. Book clubs, weaving, pottery, yoga, anything. So there's descent into the tombs, and there's ways to get involved in bringing that in. And all that is just an excuse, right, at hold, and even doing pottery together. Oftentimes it's an excuse to connect with someone right next to you, right? And so, or there is the resurrection trajectory. There's ways in the world of mass incarceration, these heavy barriers that we can go in and defy these gates of Hades through descent movements and through resurrection movements, through reentry. Which can be really complicated, and with one perishable prisoner, we're trying to make that very easy. You can plug into that. And so we really want to invite communities not only today to engage in mass incarceration in these two ways, but we really believe this is the shape of the gospel. At the end of almost every Lutheran liturgy, we proclaim the mystery of our faith, which is this is the shape of our practice. And so we really want to invite communities to not say, hey, if prison ministry is one more thing you want to add, we boldly want to invite churches to say, what if every church did this? Sex trafficking is your issue? Watch how that connects if you've been involved in incarceration. Homelessness is your issue you care about in the community? Great. Understand how many people coming out of prison are stuck right here in their reentry journey for like the last 10 years and they've been in the underground. Think about what issue your church really cares about. And I challenge you to think if it doesn't intersect with mass incarceration in America. And if this is a way to plunge with your community deeper into those realities that the community you're serving, or there's somewhere on this journey.
And just to tack one more piece onto what you just said there, Chris, like it isn't even just one more thing to add. You know, because Chris made a reference to that a second ago. I would argue that the experience of congregations have been involved with any of these things, whether it's Living Stones, underground ministries, or just other ways of being connected, it isn't putting something new on your plate. It isn't another responsibility in that sense, another stressor, another whatever. For folks who've become involved with this, I would argue it is actually a source of life. It is instead something that has fueled them into being able to do other things, other work, other ministries, which is the almost weirdly selfish thing about it. Is that it is so life-giving in that sense. And I think it comes back to something you've mentioned several times this week, Chris, and that is about the, I think because it is so inherently connected to the actual experience of the call to faith, that's why it is so in life-giving, why it is so empowering, is because it's doing what we were basically born to do. We just didn't know it until we started to do so.
Seminarians talk a lot about the Paschal mystery. Good Friday, Good Saturday, being among the dead, resurrection. This is a great way to make that very lived today. The Paschal mystery, the mystery of our faith. Alex, would you mind closing us with either the welcoming prayer or some silence or however you would want to close us in a time of prayer?
I'm still not good at this.
That's why. Come on up forward. And you know this guy, right?
He's great. Yep, he does.
That's Popeye. he used to go by Popeye. I don't know if he does anymore. Lord, thank you for this village. Thank you for these people with beautiful hearts and just tenderness in their souls. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to live and experience life in a different way. I welcome any emotions. I welcome any thoughts of insecurity, everything that I'm scared of. I welcome it because I know that I'm safe in your embrace. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.
And as we forgot to say this week, some of the staff are very kind to say, hey, don't pester the guest faculty, you know, let them be with their families. I mean, this guy's good at pestering anyway. And so please come and talk to us at the dinner tables, the lunch tables, and the walkways. We're here because we love this stuff. We'd love to connect with you further. And we have plenty, if you're interested in one personal prisoner, take one of these with you if you can. And hopefully we'll see some of you tomorrow.